So these underlying subtopics up here are what it's going to encompass. I think one of the reasons why the grades on the next test tend to be a little lower than the first and the last test, well, obviously the reason the last test is everybody's got to do it or they wouldn't show up for it. So they try the hardest there. And also they know me after the three tests. But the second test covers material that is less popular outside of the classroom. Like the first ones, the Declaration of Independence, the Revolutionary War, the Constitution, we get that in multiple classes. We get that every 4th of July in some kind of educational program. So you get exposed to that a lot. And the Civil War also is very popular. So the things that lead to the Civil War usually are a little better known. But this material from 1789 to 1848, this is an area that is less pop culture. There's some in there people have heard of. Jackson Years, War of 1812, that is. But a lot of the politics and diplomacy is new material for some people. So just dive into it as though all of it's important and all of it's exciting and you won't be encumbered by having not heard some of it before.
Would it be about chapter 8?
Do you have the syllabus gives the chapter numbers? It's supposed to. The three testing periods tell which chapters of the book it relates to. Maybe you can tell us out loud.
Okay.
It is.
It's chapter 8.
Just 8 alone, or 8 through
16?
8 through 16. Now, would you want to read 8 chapters? Of course I would, because I'm a history fanatic. But if you're not majoring in history, how should you read those 8 chapters? Strategically, look for these things in those 8 chapters. You can go to the index and just alphabetically find where these things are and read just those paragraphs in those chapters. Or hopefully, they're so close to each other that you just, in frustration, read them all anyway, because there's so much good stuff in all the paragraphs.
Okay.
But you can see there'll be sections of material that I don't even address, sometimes like social history, and so you won't have to worry about that. So let me kind of summarize real quickly what these four sheets are going to involve. We're going to look at, first, the decade from 1790 to 1800, the new nation, the new government, under Presidents Washington and Adams, who are both members of that's misleading, because Washington is not a party member. But their policies both pursue the same political party's philosophy, Federalist. Then Jefferson takes office in 1800, and there's a change with the Jefferson period up to about, the 1820s, really. But within the Jeffersonian years is the War of 1812. The post-war period is called the Era of Good Feelings. That lasts till about 1824. And then from 1828 through 1836 is the Jackson presidency, and there's much that changes there. In fact, this phrase, Jacksonian democracy, lives well beyond Jackson himself. Manifest Destiny is in the 1840s, and that deals with acquiring Western land, California, Oregon, Texas, Mexican War and such. And then very little of this last part do we cover. The reform movements of the 1830s and 40s, we'll touch on a few of those at the end. So those are subtopics that we'll be addressing. And again, my tests are predominantly, as you can tell, identification, cognitive material, more so than reasons and causes of. So, we're dealing with a new nation under the Constitution. First president was Washington, and everybody knew it would be, because he was the only one that could be trusted with power like a could-be king, and that's kind of the way we have to look at this. What was this presidency? What powers did it include? Washington was concerned that if the office was never seen as equal to a foreign monarch, it couldn't command the respect or power to protect the nation's interests. But others, and to that effect Washington somewhat too, but not as much as others, worried about what will happen to presidents who forget they're elected and start thinking they are like monarchs. So therefore, both those expectations were placed upon Washington as first president, was to dignify the office, but not go too far and not be too aloof from the people. Most historians, in looking at the way presidents behaved and shaped the early years, felt that both Washington and Adams were far more aloof and more regal than Jefferson onward. And that may just be because Jefferson changed things. Jefferson was the first to stop wearing wigs. He walked in his inauguration, something that Jimmy Carter did on purpose to try to be reminiscent of Jeffersonian hominess, I guess. Jefferson met with people in Congress and these common people that came to the White House, where Washington and Adams felt like that would degrade the office of the presidency. So a lot of firsts or precedents, I guess I should call them, that Washington was expected to carry out. John Adams was his vice president. And if you remember the way the electoral system worked, every elector had two votes, they cast for two different presidential candidates. And whoever got the majority became president, whoever got the next highest came in second, became vice president, although both in theory were competing for the presidency. And that would change later in 1804. But on his first run, John Adams made it clear he wasn't even trying to contest Washington. He was truly seeking the vice presidency, so the votes were cast with that in mind. So it was really a no race for Washington, and who would come in second was the real contest. They took office in New York City, and that's where the national capital remained until 1793 when it moved to Philadelphia. And finally, in 1800, it came to its permanent resting place, Washington, D.C. And we'll talk about how Washington was chosen to be the capital when we get down to item five, or six, rather. Again, a first that the presidents had to deal with was they need some kind of advisory body. And the king had a privy council. Ministers of parliament had their own coterie or their coalition friends to work with. So to some degree, the cabinet is a blend of posts in parliament mixed with the privy council role model in the creation of our departments. The first one created was state, which conducts foreign affairs. Because of Jefferson's long service as a diplomat to France, he was selected to be Secretary of State. Hamilton was selected to be Secretary of Treasury. That's the second office created, and that was because Hamilton wanted that post and had asked Washington years before the Constitution was even established. He used to say, "You'd be a great king, and I'd be a great First Lord of the Treasury, and we could run this country." And so Washington remembered that, remembered his ideas. Hamilton became Secretary of the Treasury. Secretary of War, which is today called Defense, went to Henry Knox, of which Fort Knox is named. So those are the first three cabinets. How many cabinets do we have today? 16, maybe? Homeland Security is the 15th, exactly. Veterans is 14th. Why were there only three then and 15 now? Did we not need some care of those affairs like transportation, commerce, and labor, and interior? Do those things, how were they taken care of back in the early days? By states or by private government? And that's where I wanted to go with this, was that in the very beginning, the idea of expanding as many as 15 cabinet positions would have been considered federal tyranny. That those are functions and details that should be left to private business or to the local government states. Do we feel now tyrannized by those things? Some complain. Some people want to dismantle certain departments. But we've just kind of evolved over the last couple centuries to see such things as depressions and world wars into believing Cold Wars that we need those. And I think we do. Well, anyway, this period from 1790 to 1800, known as the Federalist Era, it started off with no political parties. As I said before, the only political factions that had existed up to this point was West-East, Backwoods versus Tidewater Elite. And they weren't organized parties, they were just bitter factions. But political parties in the modern sense of the word that exist all across the planet got their start in the 1790s from the American model. And not so much from a positive model, really. The reason they arose is because Hamilton had such a strong, well-defined economic agenda, and he wanted to make sure that Congress and the President of Washington put these into law. And Jefferson just about stood on the opposite of every single policy he wanted. And so what really happened was Secretary of State Jefferson, in his opposition against Hamilton, Secretary of the Treasury, they began to gather their friends and their coalitions. And two factions arose, either for Hamilton's policies or you're against Hamilton's policies. And that's what evolved into the first two political parties. Those who followed Hamilton were called Federalists. Those who followed Jefferson were called Democrat Republicans. Originally, Jefferson's group, because their whole goal was anti-Hamilton, called themselves anti-Federalists, which was not the same group as our wanted to, did not want to ratify the Constitution, although a lot of them fell into the same camp. And it was only after the split appeared going to be a permanent split did they change their name to the Democratic Republicans, which is more positive. And the differences between these policies go back to the differences between the people themselves. So this, I don't know how much of this next part you have to write. I think it's something you can just hear and understand. But let's talk about the biography of these two people. Hamilton was born in the Caribbean to a poor family. And brilliant mind, but found himself surrounded by no opportunities. And so through searching the connections he had through family, he discovered wealthy relatives living in New York. And finally wrangled a way to get sent to New York and out of Jamaica, I believe. And lived in New York, met the right people, ran in the right circles, married into wealth, and became somebody of significance and importance in social strata. And that's how he got to know Washington and others. And having come up from the masses, from the common man, it was always Hamilton's belief that they are dangerous. And they are not to be trusted with voice and political power. That only those people who are the better educated elite can run government and run government fairly and wisely. I came so far as to say, if you want the common people's liberties protected, be sure to put most of the power in the hands of the elite, not those people. Because the elite understand the nuances of politics and actually will protect things in the abstract, but the common people will be swayed by whatever demagogue comes down the road and give away the freedoms. I hope that's not true. But so that was Hamilton from the beginning, was uncomfortable with democracy, small d democracy. Very much more in favor of a republican form of government. He would have preferred a constitutional monarchy. Always badgered Washington about being king. Until after the Constitution, of course. But I read somewhere that he spent almost 10 hours, when you collect all the comments at the convention, praising monarchy and praising George as a good possible monarch. I don't know how people could, even if it was an hour at a time, once a week, how they could put up with that. He also believed that America's best future lie with following the course that England had set. Now, sure enough, we had broken away from England, didn't want to be part of England, but he thought being like England was in our best interest, and that is promoting industry, promoting manufacturing, looking at farming as something that as a time was starting to pass into the past, and that government should be on the side of giving favors and tax advantages to promote mercantilism, promoting businesses, and that strong national government, which promoted business, was better than strong state government. He would have weakened the state governments to near non-existence and gone for a unitary system if he could have, like Britain's. So strong central national government, government promoting business, promoting the merchant class, favoring industrial merchant producers and traders over farmers, fearing the common man, wanting to enfranchise only the elite, and shrink the size of state governments. And when it came to business, he always favored not only a strong national government, but a strong national government that was active in the promotion of business. The idea that we have today of a government that regulates interest rates to the Federal Reserve System, or can affect the economy by spending and creating jobs, or tax cuts, or whatever, those are things that Hamilton would have been very happy with, to see an active government involved in promoting or regulating an economy. Jefferson was the opposite. He'd been born in wealth on a plantation and lived throughout most of his life as a wealthy slave-owning plantation person, except when he went broke two or three times. I don't know if Sarah shared that with you or not. On one of the occasions when he went broke, he had to sell all his books to the U.S. government in order to pay off his debts. That became the basis of the Library of Congress. So he never knew how to really manage money well, lived off wife's incomes also, and he's our liberal in the story. Didn't mean to put those two things together like that, but it bears matter. And his belief was that the common man is the future of the country. Those closest to the soil are closest to God, meaning farmers. And in theory, he meant the yeoman farmer, the subsistence farmer, was the true American, the true blessed in the eyes of God. although he wasn't in any great hurry to transfer a lot of political voice and power to those people, he always forecasted that as the country grew in education and grew in diversity, then those people would naturally be enfranchised, but he wasn't in no hurry to give it to them. His belief, therefore, was that it is the plantation owner, the big farmer, who is probably the best suited to run government. He's a physiocrat. Can you talk about physiocracy? Adam Smith, the French economist who believed in the rules of supply and demand and price quantity. Did I do that graph on the board?
Yes,
thank you. If you remember Adam Smith, he argued that who should regulate business according to Adam Smith's physiocratic thinking? This doesn't ring a bell. This is because it was on the quiz only, not the test. That's why, because it was in the pre-test material. Well, Adam Smith's theories were that if you have an endless amount of sellers and demanders in an open competitive market with lots of choices, that equilibrium point of price and quantity will naturally be arrived at by market natural laws, not by government. And that if government stepped in and intervened with mercantile laws, with regulatory policies, all you do is just create shortages and surpluses, that it's a problem. So therefore, Adam Smith, was a propounder of what two-word French phrase?
Laissez-faire.
And laissez-faire meant the government that stays out, let alone. So that's the opposite of Hamilton. Hamilton would have government involved, actually directing and moving and shaping economic growth for the country. And what Jefferson believed in as a physiocrat, as a follower of Adam Smith, was that in the spirit of the Enlightenment, it's the government that governs least, governs best, especially in economic policies. So from the way I've kind of defined these two people, that is, Jefferson is being sympathetic to the common man, identifying, even if he's more like a rich Ted Kennedy than a common man, but he's sympathizing with the common man and claiming he was the liberal and claiming that Hamilton's more the conservative, but in economic terms, does that look familiar? It's kind of upside down, isn't it? Because in today's picture, we see liberals as the one who want to have all the government programs and regulatory policies, and we see conservatives as the one who want the laissez-faire non-regulated economy. The way to explain this discrepancy is that when it came to the view of people and the view of social behavior, the conservatives and liberals have not changed since the 1790s. But when it comes to government's involvement with economics, at the turn of the 20th century on up through the 1930s, that's when they swapped upside down policies. So, but we're not in the 20th century, so just to keep you back here, clear all this up. There's a couple of multiple choice questions that ask which of the following would prefer which policy. So to clear all that up again, Hamilton would have pursued a larger role for federal government, less role for state government, and that federal government should be actively involved in regulating, directing, and stimulating the economic growth. That is going to, by automatic means, say that the government favors the merchant class over the farmers, and yes, he did feel that way. He thought farming as a business would start to shrink and industrial production would begin to grow. That you could buy enough food from else places and sell your products that are manufactured at a greater profit for everybody. Distrusted the common man, felt that power should be in the hands of the elite, that more of power should be lodged at the national government level. And Jefferson was the opposite. Jefferson was a laissez-faire proponent of free markets, of unregulated markets. If there needs to be government power, it's better to give more of the power to states than the national government. So in that respect, he was very much concerned with, yes, we need a constitution. This is Jefferson talking. Yes, if the articles failed, it was obvious we needed a stronger national government. We have one. Let's don't let it get any stronger. Let's hold rein on the national government. If there needs to be any leeway of giving more power, let it go to states. And someday the meek shall inherit the earth, not in a hurry, but the common man shall become the people who will rule. And Jefferson's belief on that was that when education becomes available and widespread to all, they'll naturally be able to step up and take power. Now that's the introduction to these people here, which kind of fed into number five a little bit there. There's one other thing that distinguished the difference between these two people and, of course, these two parties, since that's what they represent. And that was foreign policy. in foreign policy, Jefferson always felt it was our obligations and our best interests if we buddied up to France more than England, even during the French Revolution, because we owed them a debt and because we didn't like England as much. And Hamilton went the other way. Hamilton wanted to mimic the English bank, the English mercantile policies. And when the French Revolution broke out, Hamilton was very uncomfortable with the idea of rabble masses burning down churches, killing their rich people, and cutting the heads off kings and such. That didn't seem to be elite rule the way it should be. So Hamilton was against the French Revolution. That comes a little later in our story. But that sizes up the differences between the two parties. Before we do 6 and 7, let me just blabber for a while and you don't write things down. This is part of those areas where I used to have more chapter and I cut it out. It's really hard to cut it out, so it's kind of like putting the wax in the ears and getting to hear the sirens anyway, but strapped to the mast. If I tell you it's not on the test, you don't have to write it down, then I can just kind of say some of this. It helps me understand the lecture better if I do the part of the whole lecture this way. It's like naming the grandkids to do all 16 to hit the last one, type thing. I'm already to that point. What happened here is that Hamilton put forth 4 different proposals to Congress. You don't have to write this down just yet. 4 different proposals to Congress. The first one was how to pay off the war debt. The second one, which is going to be number 6, the creation of a government bank, a national bank. The third one, which is going to be number 7, the whiskey tax. And the fourth one, like one not listed, was called the Report on the Manufacturers. Let me talk about 1 and 4, the ones that we're not going to cover. A couple of reasons. They're interesting, and you may run across them in your reading, and you'll say, well, he didn't cover this. I'm confused. I'm lost. Now you won't be confused, lost. You'll know you're not supposed to read it. First one, on the debt funding, there was about a total $72 million debt to be paid off. About, I think, $22 million of that states owed their citizens. Of the remaining 50, I'm thinking about half of that was owed to foreign nations and the other half was owed by the Continental Congress to individual citizens. So the look at this is states take care of their own debt. We've got to pay foreign countries off immediately or otherwise we lose credit around the world. Then we'll deal with the issue of how does the Continental Congress pay off its own citizens. Well, what Hamilton proposed was, well, first let me say to Jefferson. Jefferson said this. When individual citizens bought the Continental Congress war bonds during the war, throughout the 1780s, there was a loss of confidence that they'd ever be redeemed because the Articles of Confederation couldn't tax and couldn't raise money. And so some people began to get itchy in the need for money, and when speculators would come by and say, I'll give you, you know, a dime on the dollar for your war bonds, they'd sell them because they thought they're never going to get redeemed. And the speculators probably figured they wouldn't get redeemed either, but at such a low price, it was worth buying. So certain people from the East went out and got, among poor farmers of the West, a lot of their war bonds up at cheap prices, hoping that someday they may be redeemed for full value. Well, now that the Constitution's established, Hamilton, this is the first report to Congress, argues not only do we need to pay foreign countries in full, not only do the states need to pay their citizens in full, but we need to pay back bondholders full face value for those bonds to show that there is credibility in our government. To which Jefferson would argue, this is not the same government. The Constitution did not sell these war bonds, the Continental Congress did. Articles did. I understand the need for confidence in government, but let's look at this. A large number of these bonds are not in the hands of the original holders. They're in the hands of speculators who are going to make a killing if you fund them at full face value. What he proposed was, let's find some formula to whoever owns them when they bought them. We'll give them a fair value for what they paid for them, but nobody makes a big killing speculating off of others. How would that be kept up with? No way, that's an accounting nightmare. It couldn't be done. So Hamilton continued to press Congress and the President for full face value, even if it meant some people make a a good profit off of other people's sufferings, it would show credibility that the government stands by its debts. And Hamilton was so persuasive that he got Congress and Washington on board to agree to that. So the Revolutionary War debt that the Continental Congress owed individual citizens was paid in full face value. The state debt, and here's something I think you might want to write down, because this is just of real great interest. Probably not on the test, but it's a great value. Hamilton suggested, now that the federal government is far more powerful than it used to be, it should take on those state debts. Assumptions, it's called. It should assume the payment of those state debts. Now, his reasoning, of course, was that it had two reasons there. One is it meant in order to pay debts, you have to have money. How do you get money? You tax. And you sell bonds again. So this is his way. And who's going to be buying most of those bonds and paying most of those taxes? Well, the people with the deep-pocketed folk. And so especially if you're selling government bonds to the elite, the elite will want to make sure that that government survives to get paid back. So right away, part of his agenda is at work here. How to fuse the interests of the wealthy merchant class with the new government so that both take care of each other. Sell bonds in order to pay off the assumed state debts. Another reason that Hamilton wanted state debts assumed was the same reason Jefferson was so strongly against it. That is, southern states, rural states, Democrat-Republican Party states, had paid off most of their war debts. And it was still the New England commercial states that were sitting on unpaid debt, so it would help benefit the community that would re-elect Federalists. So the argument over whether or not the national government should assume state debts became heated, and the story has it that Washington took Jefferson and Hamilton out for a sailboat ride, got them both seasick, and then told them he wouldn't come back until they made some kind of a deal on what to do about state debts. Well, true they did, but that's the story. And the deal they came up with is that Hamilton gets his way, the state debts will be assumed, but that the national capital will be located permanently in a southern location. And that's how D.C. was selected to be the capital of the United States for southern purposes. Okay, that's all item one of the four reports that are not on a test, but just of interest. Let's do item four, which is also not on the test. Don't have to write this down either. But this tells us something important about Hamilton. Report on the manufacturers. This proposal, which failed, in fact it's the only one of the four that did fail, the first three all passed, proposed two things. A high protective tariff and bounties for specific designated industries. High protective tariff meant a tax on foreign goods that was so high that people just wouldn't even buy the foreign goods. So it was not a tax that would raise money for the government. It was a tax that would eliminate buying foreign products and promote home production. That never passed. Instead, a lower tariff for revenue was passed. The other part of that proposal, bounties or grants of money would be given to specific designated industries. The argument being we need to get certain industries off the ground rolling to be competitive with England so that we're not at their mercy and we can in fact outsell them. Of course, what does that look like? If you're giving chunks of money to specific businesses like to Halliburton or maybe Chevrolet or something like that, cronyism. It's not fair. It's not only government where it doesn't belong in the economy, but not even doing it in a fair way. But to a certain degree, what's the Hamilton view? What's the justification for this? What's the big picture gain from giving designated bounties to certain... how do you explain it to the common ordinary person who tills a farm and doesn't own a business that is good? Well, it'll generate so much economic growth. It's trickle down. Yeah. It'll generate so much economic growth that as America starts to outsell England, it'll create more jobs, diversify the economy, and everybody's standard of living will rise. Which was true. It was a good idea, and it did work. even though it didn't pass, but that came to be true from natural growth of American business. So those are the two that were not on the test, but since you might find that telling about Hamilton. Report 2 and 3, we are going to take notes on here in 6 and 7. So, item 6. Hamilton proposed the creation of a national bank or a Bank of the United States. It was a bank that would hold $10 million worth of deposits. $2 million would be government funds. Where are the other $8 million going to come from? Hopefully. From merchant class investors who are buying interest into this bank. Again, it's an effort to try to fuse the interests, obligate the interests of the wealthy merchant class with the national government. Also, this bank could serve to regulate currency. How could that be? He's using the English model here, he hopes. They would issue notes, bank notes.
Okay.
The money that was, can I say this? The official currency that was coined, or issued, there's my verb. The official currency that was issued from the start of the country up until 1913 was coinage, not paper money. There were exceptions. Continental Congress did some during the war. During the Civil War, there was some paper greenbacks issued. But outside of those rare occasions, the only money that was issued by the federal government would be coinage. So the paper money that circulated through the 19th century is all issued by banks, either this national bank or by private-owned banks. So since a lot of the money in circulation came from private banks, how could you guarantee the value of that? You really couldn't. There were no bank regulatory laws then. That was a laissez-faire period. So what Hamilton dreamed up was this, or copied from the English, I should say, is the bank issues bank notes, but it also buys bank notes, buys state private bank's notes, buys enough of them to someday just show up on their doorstep one day and demand that you redeem all these bank notes in gold and silver coinage. If you never knew when the bank was, it'd be like the pop quiz with no warning. Wouldn't that be cool if we had that? People study every night. That wouldn't be cool. But if the bank could show up any time and demand redemption for the banknotes, you'd have to keep enough coinage on reserve that you don't float worthless notes. So that was Hamilton's view. A bank that regulated paper currency just by being an intimidator, and whose notes would be guaranteed valuable because it's the U.S. government. Does that sound like a good plan?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's what we use, the Federal Reserve System. It's a great plan. So why would Jefferson be opposed to it?
He doesn't like
Hamilton personally, it's true, but because he's what?
Because Hamilton proposed it.
Yeah, and he came to hate Hamilton after the program, not before. But, so he hates programs first and he comes to hate Hamilton. Well, what's wrong with that program? Yes, it's not laissez-faire, it's way too much federal government involved in the economy, it's putting way too much power in the hands of the elite, especially when you consider they're going to own 4/5 of this bank. Now people scream about foreign investors owning parts of America. Well, that's how he saw it, that to have this elite special privileged class owning 4/5 of this lending institution is definitely not, it's not liberty, it's not economic liberty. Plus he also argued, in addition to who's going to have their, you know, cat fattened, it's also a case of it's illegal. Jefferson would say, where in the Constitution is Congress authorized to make banks? They can declare war, they can appropriate the army, they can do a lot of things, but there's nowhere in there does it say can create banks. Therefore, it's unconstitutional and illegal to make such an institution. What's the Hamilton response? It is legal. He could have gone from him, he didn't give him. He says it's already there. Just take another look at Congress's powers. I hope I put this in the lecture. Did I ever talk about the elastic clause?
Yeah.
So the implied powers clause or elastic clause are necessary and proper. Hamilton's argument was, through the Elastic Clause, Congress has the authority to make whatever laws are necessary and proper, and the banks won't. That isn't how Jefferson saw it, but it is the way Congress and Washington saw it. And so therefore, the bank passed also. So that's why we say this is the Federalist era, because the government policies that get passed are the ones that Hamilton spearheaded and that Washington signed into law. Now, when asked if Washington was took side with either of these two political parties, he was always outspoken about, I am not a member of any party. I think political parties are bad. They're dangerous to the country. Even cutting off the king's head, factions. So we don't even have political parties. Let's don't talk about that. Yet he always took just about every time Hamilton's view on an issue and signed those bills. So that's why some textbooks will confuse you by saying Washington was a Federalist. He wasn't a card-carrying Federalist. He was just a running dog. He used the old Cold War jargon and slang. He just cited all the time. The term strict and loose construction is something I should have used in my discussion here. Let's talk about what that terminology, you'll see that in textbooks a lot. A strict or loose construction of the Constitution is a phrase that means to take an exact or a broad view of what powers government should have. A strict construction of the Constitution would be government can only do exactly what is spelled out. That'd be the Jefferson view. A loose construction or a broad construction of the Constitution says, what's the spirit of the Constitution? Spirit of the Constitution would be for Congress to be able to influence economic health. Therefore, you can use the Elastic Clause to make a bank. So that's a loose construction of the Constitution. In most cases, one who loosely interprets the Constitution intends on purpose to add more power to government. And those who are strict constructionists want to hold government power in check. Up into our current day today, in fact, just this morning you may have seen in the paper, there was an article telling the background of Harriet Myers, the new appointee to the court. And in the second paragraph, it has a quote from Bush and says that he believes she is someone who will interpret the Constitution rather than make law from the bench or legislate from the bench. That's, again, that idea of whether or not you strictly interpret the role of the judge or you broaden the powers of the judge to hand down rulings that are like laws. So we still have those kind of debates today. So in this respect, the loose constructionist view of the Constitution won out when Hamilton got that bank passed. How are we on time? That time. The whiskey tax. This is a good one. Item 7. Farmers who lived west of the Appalachians found it much more profitable to turn their corn into distilled whiskey and bring it over the mountains and sell it that way because for the effort involved you made more profit. Hamilton proposed, at the same time that he's proposing high protective tariffs, and that's a tax too. And let's go back to that a second, one you didn't have to write down. But a high protective tariff, does that help or hurt business? Helps business. Yes, yes. So a high protective tariff helps the merchant class. While at the same time he's proposing that, he's proposing a whiskey tax on Western farmers. Does that help or hurt the farmers? Hurts them. So here he's obviously got tax policies to benefit the wealthy at the expense of the poor, or the eastern seaboard elite at the expense of the western frontier people. Why would he do that? It's worse than your answer is going to sound. Whatever you say, I'm going to make it worse when I explain it. Why do you think he did it? Yeah, and you said it as gently as how it's helped you with it, to help his community, further the merchant class, because that's who were his buds. His real purpose was to anger the West. He hopes he makes them mad enough that they won't be loyal to this government, that they'll rise in rebellion, because they're the ones who are the most against the ratification of the Constitution. He figured we don't want any elements thinking that they can be like the regulators out in North Carolina. We don't want any elements thinking that they can just ignore. They're going to take it and like it that we have a strong central government. And if we give them a tax they don't like, they might just rise up in rebellion. And if the rebellion occurs, who's the commander in chief that wants to put him down? Washington. If Washington slaps him down, everybody knows there's the central government. And that's what happened. 1794, farmers in western Pennsylvania angrily went on the warpath. Washington was told by Hamilton that there is a rebellion in the states, that the commander-in-chief must lead the militia to rest to protect the Constitution. Washington gets there and finds out it's not nearly as severe, as large as Hamilton lied and exaggerated to be. And so after arresting the rebel leaders, they're all pardoned and let go. But it had its effect. It demonstrated exactly what Hamilton wanted, that there is a strong central government and there will be no tolerance for rebellions against this. Now, this will kind of come back to haunt Hamilton, because later these western areas, these western people who were apolitical at this point, they become just ardent Jeffersonians because they hate Hamilton. And when western states start to enter the Union, they're all Jeffersonian because they all hate Hamilton for this. And when the man who shoots and kills Hamilton, who's that? Aaron Burr, takes refuge from murder charges out in western states. All he has to do is walk up to a family farm and say, "I shot Hamilton. Come on in, stay as long as you want. Food and clothing is for you." That's how much westerners hated Hamilton because of the whiskey tax and subsequent rebellion. Number 8, when we return.